Executive Power, Disc 9.
The president then shifted his gaze back in the other direction and settled on Irene Kennedy. Rapp watched all of this from a few chairs down. The president was sitting with his back to the window, his national security adviser Michael Hake on his left and his chief of staff Valerie Jones on his right. Across the table and next to the attorney general were Secretary of State Beatrice Berg and Secretary of Defense Rick Culbertson. Hayes kept his eyes fixed on Kennedy, his agitation clearly visible in the way he tensed his jaw. "What have the Israelis had to say about this?" Kennedy was prepared for the question. If the president wanted to know what the Israeli response was to the killings, he would have asked Secretary of State Berg. Instead, he'd asked the director of the CIA, which meant he wanted to know what Mossad had to say about the assassination. She'd already spoken to Ben Friedman 3 times, and on each occasion he had vociferously denied having had anything to do with it.
"Sir, Director General Friedman denies categorically that Mossad had a hand in what happened last night."
The president looked doubtful. "Why should I believe him?" The question could be answered in many ways, none of them good. Friedman had wasted what little trust the president had in him, and Kennedy doubted there was anything she could say or do that could rebuild the damage. She would have preferred to stay quiet on the issue, but the president wanted an answer.
"I don't think Mossad would risk doing something this brazen."
"And why's that?" asked Hayes.
"Simple cost-benefit, sir. Killing Ambassador Ali gains them very little, and as we are sure to see as the day progresses, it'll cost them greatly in the international community."
"That line of reasoning would work if they actually gave a rat's ass what the international community thought. But as we saw with the attack on Hebron over the weekend, I'm not so sure they much care what the rest of the world thinks."
Valerie Jones nodded. "I would agree."
Several other people seconded her opinion. Secretary of State Beatrice Berg, however, dissented.
"I don't see it that way. They might think very little of the UN, but they certainly care what we think."
The president immediately turned his attention back to Kennedy. "Everyone here is familiar with what Israel says took place in Hebron over the weekend, correct?" All the attendees nodded. Hayes turned his gaze on Kennedy. "Now, Irene, would you please share with the rest of the group what really happened?" Kennedy sighed ever so slightly. This was compartmentalized information, and she had no desire to disseminate it to the various agencies represented in the room. She knew, though, that any attempt to try to convince the president otherwise would be useless. Reluctantly, she began.
"Through assets on the ground and reconnaissance photographs, we've discovered that there was no bomb-making factory in Hebron."
Kennedy looked through her glasses at the confused expressions of the other high-level officials.
"The damage that was done was not caused by a secondary explosion."
"And what in the hell was it caused by?" asked Secretary of Defense Culbertson. After a brief hesitation, Kennedy said,
16 Hellfire missiles were fired into the neighborhood."
With a confused frown on his face, Culbertson asked, "Why?"
"That's the million-dollar question," replied the president in an unfriendly tone.
"Well, what does Friedman have to say about all of this?"
The president leaned back in his chair and looked to Kennedy for the answer. "He's sticking with their story that there was a bomb-making factory."
"How sure are we," asked Secretary of State Berg, "that there was no bomb factory, that all of the damage was caused by the missiles?"
"The evidence is pretty clear-cut."
"How clear-cut?"
Kennedy thought about the satellite images and the reports she'd received from their people on the ground. She normally preferred to avoid going too far out on a limb, but on this one she felt confident.
"I'd say the evidence we have convincingly contradicts the story that is being put out by the Israeli government."
"So what you're telling us," interjected Culbertson, "is that we can't trust what our only ally in the region is telling us."
The president nodded.
"That about sums it up. Beatrice, what does the Israeli ambassador have to say about last night?"
Berg had not called Prime Minister Goldberg, nor had she called the Israeli ambassador. In the skilled game of diplomacy, the higher-ups avoided asking questions of each other that might force lies to be told. So one of Berg's underlings had called the deputy chief of mission for an unofficial response to the assassination of the Palestinian ambassador. The ambassador's number 2 man had dismissed any involvement by Israel as ludicrous. This was only the first round, and the answer was expected. As the drama unfolded, tougher questions would be put to people with more weighty titles.
"The embassy," started Berg, "is saying exactly what we'd expect them to say."
"That they had no involvement," answered the president.
Berg nodded.
"Irene," asked the president, "what do we know about Ali? Is there any reason that we know of why the Israelis would want him killed, or more precisely, why Ben Friedman would want him killed?"
"As with all things between the Israelis and the Palestinians, there is ample motive. Ali grew up in Gaza and was an active member in the terrorist group Force 17, and then later with the PLO. The Israelis claim that, like Arafat, he was a terrorist and still is a terrorist. More recently, there have been accusations of fundraising for the martyr brigades and some questionable acquaintances with people who run in the wrong circles."
"What kind of circles?" asked Hayes.
"People who deal in arms trafficking."
Valerie Jones, who had been quiet up until now, asked, "Is that information we collected on our own or intelligence that was provided by the Israelis?"
"That's information we gathered through our own sources."
"So," began the president, "do you see anything in Ali's recent history that would warrant Mossad wanting to kill him?"
The president was fixated on Friedman, and Kennedy couldn't really blame him. Despite Friedman's denials, Kennedy had been thinking quite a bit about the possibility that he had ordered the assassination of Ali. There were many logical reasons why Friedman should not have ordered such a bold move, but on the other hand, recently he had proven to be increasingly unpredictable and brazen. The president was looking to Kennedy for an answer, and she settled on an honest, if somewhat cautious, course.
"A year ago, sir, I would have not thought Ben Friedman capable of such a drastic move, but today I'm not so sure."
Kennedy hesitated for a moment as if she were about to say something else, and then stopped. The president picked up on this and said, "What is it?"
"I'm trying to step back and see the big picture from the Israelis' point of view. It's been a bloody couple of years for them. The homicide bombers have taken a massive toll in both life and morale. Israel already receives almost no support from the international community. So in that regard, they risk almost nothing. They could be expanding the war, an extension of their attitude that if you hit them, they will hit you back even harder."
President Hayes nodded.
"Hit the Palestinians where they feel safest and keep them off balance."
Kennedy shrugged.
"It's a possibility. One that I think is a bit of a stretch, but a possibility."
Hayes seemed to like this line of thinking. It gave him something he could get his hands around to explain why Friedman would do something so reckless. In a final effort to draw out any disagreement, Hayes asked,
"Can anyone right now come up with a suspect other than Mossad?"
Rapp had been listening keenly to the discussion, and despite his complete lack of faith in Ben Friedman, he thought there were quite a few other possibilities that should be explored. He also knew a few things that the others didn't, but under orders from Kennedy, he was to keep his opinions to himself until they were alone with the president. Chapter 53. Prime Minister Goldberg had never in his life felt so beleaguered. This was worse than the Yom Kippur War, when he had been surrounded by Syrian forces and shelled until his ears bled, and ordered by his commanders to hold his position until a counterattack could be mounted. He had hung on for 3 days without sleep. He and his men were fighting a much larger Syrian force in a bloody battle for the Golan Heights. The counterattack eventually arrived, and an angry Israeli army threw the Syrians back across the border and closed to within spitting distance of Damascus. Then the United States and the Soviet Union had stepped in and tried to separate the belligerents like fighting children on a playground. Goldberg would never forget the lesson he learned in 1973, and that was to never trust his Arab neighbors. They had attacked on the holiest Jewish holiday of the year, when Israelis were either at home or in their synagogues praying. For the first 3 days, they had hammered the Jewish people, and then, when the Israeli army regrouped and pushed both the Egyptians and the Syrians back across their borders, the Arabs screamed for international intervention. They launched a sneak attack and then whined for peace and, of course, wanted their land back, even though thousands of Israelis lay dead. Under the pressure of an Arab oil embargo, the United States had forced Israel to pull back and concede much of the land they had captured in a war they did not start.
How many times did the world have to see proof that Arabs could not be trusted? It frustrated Goldberg to no end that the leaders of Europe refused to see things as they were. It saddened him deeply that despite everything his people had been through on that cursed continent, that they did not come to the aid of Israel. All Goldberg wanted for his people was a safe place to live. And if things weren't already bad enough having to deal with suicidal Palestinians and bigoted heads of state, he now had to contend with dissenters within his own government. He was tired. The years of leading the fight had taken their toll, and Goldberg's energy was beginning to wane. At the rate things were going, there was a good chance he wouldn't survive the week without being subjected to a vote of no confidence. To start with, the UN and a healthy number of his cabinet members were up in arms over the events in Hebron, and now someone had assassinated the Palestinian ambassador in New York City. One of Goldberg's aides had briefed him on the assassination during breakfast, and his private reaction to the news had been one of desperate fear. The very first person who came to mind was his old friend and the director general of Mossad, Ben Friedman. Goldberg had been asking himself all day if Friedman was capable of launching such a disastrous operation on his own. The answer was a startling yes, which made him all the more uncomfortable with the meeting that was about to take place. The Prime Minister would have preferred to let the problem fade away. There was enough bloodshed in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict that the ambassador's death would fade to the background sooner than one would think. But unfortunately, for the next month or two, things were sure to get worse. It was still early in America, but Goldberg had no doubt that as the day progressed, President Hayes, or more likely, Secretary of State Berg, would be on the phone demanding assurances that Israel had had no hand in the brutal act. Goldberg was tempted to bury his head in the sand, but that would be foolish and contrary to his character. He needed the truth from Friedman, and then, after that, he could decide what to say to the Americans. He ran a frustrated hand through his thin white hair and looked at his wall clock. It was approaching 2:30 in the afternoon. Friedman was late, which was not a surprise. The head of Mossad came and went as he wished. It was a few minutes later that Friedman finally arrived to find a nervous prime minister sitting behind his desk. Friedman knew what this was about. He was the prime suspect in the assassination of Ambassador Ali. In contrast to the prime minister's suit, Friedman was dressed casually in slacks and a loose-fitting, short-sleeved dress shirt. As always, the shirt was untucked to conceal the .38-caliber revolver he carried in a belt holster at the small of his back. Friedman never went anywhere without it. Slowly, he lowered himself into one of the two armchairs opposite Goldberg's desk. The beleaguered expression on his friend's face did not go unnoticed.
"David, you do not look good."
Goldberg had the type of face that had surrendered to gravity almost completely. It was hard to believe that this roly-poly man had served in combat. He shook his head, heavy jowls sagging. "I am in the fight of my life." Friedman interpreted this comment as the exaggeration of a politician who had lost perspective. In a voice void of any compassion or sympathy, Friedman said, "This is nothing." Looking up under hooded eyes, Goldberg studied the supremely confident head of Mossad and felt a bit of anger spark from within. "Maybe you haven't noticed lately, Ben, but my cabinet is about to fall apart. The UN is screaming for inspectors to be sent into Hebron, and after what happened in New York last night, it's a foregone conclusion that they will pass a resolution."
"And you can tell them to stick their resolution."
Goldberg slammed his fist down on his desk, cutting Friedman off. "I will be able to tell them no such thing," he yelled, "because I will no longer be prime minister. Thanks to you, I will be long gone before the first inspector arrives."
"You're exaggerating," responded Friedman with a disgusted shake of his head.
"Exaggerating," snapped Goldberg. "I'm doing no such thing. You have gotten me into this mess due to your overzealous actions in Hebron."
"Don't criticize me for being overzealous. The whole reason you were elected was because the Israeli people wanted someone who would be overzealous."
"You didn't need to level the whole damn neighborhood," Goldberg shot back.
"Yes, I did," screamed Friedman. "Remember Farid al-Din? We sent a missile right into his car and he walked away. I wasn't going to make that mistake again." "So you destroyed an entire neighborhood." "You're damn right I did. This is a war."
Goldberg let out a frustrated sigh and through gritted teeth said, "I know it's a war, but there are other issues to consider."
"Like what?"
"Like our allies."
"You mean our allies who firebombed Dresden and Tokyo and then dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki?"
Friedman stared back at the Prime Minister with righteous conviction. They'd had this discussion many times before, and their views were identical.
"War is ugly, and sometimes you save more lives in the long run by being more brutal than your enemy. We should expel every Palestinian from the occupied territories and not allow them back until every major Arab state signs a peace treaty with us and damn the international community."
The Prime Minister shook his head. "You know better than that. The political will to launch such an operation isn't there."
"Why don't we find out?"
Goldberg was angry at himself for getting so far off track. Friedman had once again shown that he was willing to go to great lengths to get what he wanted. Maybe, Goldberg thought, he would even be so devious as to put me in a position where I had no choice but to lash out. He looked hard at the Director General of Mossad and wondered just how far he'd go to get what he wanted. The answer, he knew, was that he would go very far indeed. "Look me in the eye, and tell me what role you had in the death of the Palestinian ambassador." It was easy to offend some people, but not Ben Friedman. Goldberg might as well have asked him what he'd had for lunch.
"I had absolutely nothing to do with Ali's murder."
Goldberg searched for some hint that his old friend was lying to him. After only a second or two, he knew it was a worthless exercise. He'd seen the man on too many occasions lie with the same impunity as he told the truth. "Did Mossad have anything to do with the ambassador's death?" Friedman shook his head.
"I might be crazy, David, but I am not stupid. Why would I be so dumb as to kill the Palestinian ambassador to the UN while he is in America?"
He frowned dismissively.
"I do not mourn Ali's death. He was a two-bit thug dressed up as a diplomat. He's in Ramallah almost every month. If I wanted him dead, there would be easier ways to do it, with far fewer repercussions."
These words had the opposite effect on Goldberg than he had intended. Through Friedman's defense, the Prime Minister glimpsed the very reason why he might have thought he could get away with killing the ambassador. Sound-minded people would eventually decide that the Director General of Mossad would never risk offending the Americans when he could simply kill the ambassador when he was visiting the West Bank. Now, Goldberg was truly worried. What if one of his closest advisers was working behind the scenes to provoke an all-out war? Friedman could tell that Goldberg was not buying his denial. In a more ingratiating tone, he said, "I promise you, David, I had nothing to do with this. I have already spoken to Director Kennedy, and she believes Ali's assassination may have something to do with a business deal gone bad." Friedman was stretching the truth a bit, but felt it was needed. Goldberg gave him a skeptical look.
"What kind of business deal?" "Ali has been known to deal in arms from time to time."
"Weapons?"
"Yes."
Friedman was happy to see this seemed to give the Prime Minister some hope.
"And you say the Americans knew about these activities?"
"Yes, as do the French, British, Germans, Russians, and I'm sure quite a few other intelligence agencies."
"I would like to see Ali's file as soon as possible and give the Americans everything we have on him."
"It's already in process." Goldberg felt a little bit better, but he still had the Hebron disaster to contend with.
"Assuming we are fortunate enough to be cleared of any wrongdoing in Ali's death, it will still be too late to help us with the Hebron thing. With the current political mood, the UN is sure to vote for inspectors by today or tomorrow."
"Have the United States stall?"
"They won't, not right now."
"Then just deny the inspectors access."
Goldberg had already thought it through and discussed it with his closest political advisers. Dejectedly, he replied,
"I can't. It would be political suicide. My cabinet would fall apart, and I'd get a no-confidence vote within 24 hours.
Friedman knew he was right, but wasn't willing to give in so easily. The two men sat in silence, both of them trying to find a way out of this complicated mess.
Friedman had come up with only one option when his thoughts were interrupted by a muffled rumble coming from outside the building. Both he and the Prime Minister got to their feet and went to the window, just as another explosion was heard in the distance. Unfortunately, this was a noise they had become all too familiar with. Within minutes, reports were streaming into the Prime Minister's office. Three suicide bombs had gone off within minutes of each other, two in West Jerusalem and one in Tel Aviv. The damage and death toll was unknown, but expected to be high. Emergency response teams were at each site and searching frantically to make sure no other bombs were set to explode. It was a new and particularly evil trick of the martyr brigades to set secondary devices to detonate later and kill the paramedics who rushed to the scene to help the victims. Friedman grabbed Goldberg by the elbow and led him into a corner out of earshot from his aides. "This is your opportunity." "How could this be an opportunity?" "Send in the army and declare a curfew on Hebron. Secure the area and leave the rest up to me. By the time the UN inspectors arrive, there will be ample evidence of a bomb-making factory. You will stifle the critics in your cabinet, and the UN will be appeased." Goldberg thought about it for a second, then slowly began to nod. It was his only option. It was war. And in war, the truth was almost always the first casualty. Chapter 54. The rest of the meeting at the White House was dominated by what would happen at the UN. They all agreed that Israel was about to be strung up and that for the first time, the United States might not be able to stem the backlash. Valerie Jones gave everyone a stern warning about the press. No one was to give any interviews without checking with her first. The last thing they needed right now was individual cabinet members and administration officials contradicting each other. Storms like these could be weathered, but only if everyone hung together. They could not afford to have the Hayes administration look as if it were in disarray. When the president ended the meeting by standing, Kennedy caught Jones's eye and held up five fingers. The president's chief of staff nodded and looked down at her appointment book. The president's day was already running behind, but Jones was more than up to the task of juggling meetings and canceling or shortening events. Kennedy didn't ask often, and considering the events of last night, her request was undoubtedly important. Jones looked over at her boss, who was talking to Secretary of State Berg. They were standing under a portrait of Theodore Roosevelt. The chief of staff returned her attention to Kennedy and said, "Wait in the Oval, and I'll bring him in as soon as I can tear him away." Kennedy thanked her and then left the cabinet room with Rapp and Turbis. As the three of them entered the Oval Office, Rapp said, "He already has his mind made up on this thing."
"Yeah, I know."
"He's not going to like what we have to say," added Rapp.
"No, he won't."
Before the three of them had a chance to settle in, the president entered the office with Jones and his personal secretary. The president went straight to his desk and deposited a leather folder. His personal secretary began reciting a list of things that needed his attention, while Jones stood off to one side looking through a stack of pink message slips that one of her people had just handed her. She froze on one and then looked up to the president.
"The Saudi ambassador wants to see you as soon as possible."
Kennedy suddenly became very interested in what the president had to say to his chief of staff. She took several steps forward and listened. Hayes had a very warm relationship with the Saudis. Almost without thought, he replied, "Set it up."
"Sir, if I may."
Kennedy stepped even closer. Looking to the president's secretary, the DCI said,
"Betty, would you please excuse us?"
The secretary honored Kennedy's request without hesitation. Once she was gone and the soundproof door was closed, Kennedy said,
"Sir, there have been some developments that I think you need to know about before you schedule that meeting with the ambassador."
Hayes raised a suspicious eyebrow. "Such as?" Kennedy gestured toward the two couches by the fireplace.
"I think we should sit. This might take some time."
Hayes paused for a moment as he looked down at the workload on his desk, but then agreed. Kennedy and Turbis sat on one couch while Jones and the president took the other one. Rapp chose to stand rather than sit. Kennedy started by saying,
"Early this morning, we received some intel from the Brits. As you know, per our informal agreement with the Saudis, we do not spy on them in an active fashion.
The Brits, however, have no such agreement and are kind enough to share with us whatever they dig up.
Kennedy never wasted the president's time, so he assumed this was good.
And what did they dig up?
Kennedy opened a red file marked Eyes Only and was about to hand it to the president when she decided it would be easier if she showed it to him. Getting up, she moved to the other couch and sat on the president's left. She pointed to a 5x8 black-and-white photograph and asked, "Do you know who this is?"
Hayes studied the photo of a plump man wearing a suit and walking into a hotel surrounded by several people, including one very large Asian man. It was obvious from the quality of the shot that it was a surveillance photograph. There was something oddly familiar about the man in the suit, but the president couldn't place him. After a moment, he shook his head and said, "No." In a way, this surprised Kennedy, and then again, it didn't. Prince Omar had a very strange relationship with his royal family. Kennedy had yet to figure out if his lack of official association was by choice or by the edict of his brother, the crown prince.
"His name is Prince Omar. He's a bit of an outcast from the royal family."
"Why?"
"He's led a very flashy life over the years. He's a big gambler, a womanizer, and recreational drug user."
"He sounds like quite a few of the other family members."
"Yes, but he's the direct brother to the crown prince, and 15 years ago was in real contention with his brother to become king. He's very outspoken, and unlike many of his cousins, uncles, and nephews, he's actually made a fortune all on his own."
"That is unusual," admitted the president.
"The 5,000-plus Saudi royal family was notorious for their lavish spending habits, not for their ability to support themselves."
"How did he make his money?"
"Banking and real estate."
Hayes looked at another photo of the prince and said, "So why is he an outcast?"
"He's very critical of his brother in regard to cooperating with the West in the war on terrorism."
Hayes nodded knowingly. He was no stranger to the hypocrisy of many of the Saudi royals.
"They were educated in the West. They vacationed in the West. They spent as much time as possible in the West, enjoying the fruits of free democratic societies, and then returned home to bash the West and pander to the neoconservative mullahs and imams."
"So why are you bringing him to my attention this morning?"
"In light of what happened in New York last night, I thought you should see this right away."
Kennedy reached over and flipped through a few more photographs until she found the one she was looking for.
"Last week, Prince Omar's yacht was anchored at Monte Carlo. MI6 had him under surveillance and photographed this man being ferried to his yacht." "Why did they have him under surveillance?" asked Jones. "The Brits didn't offer and I didn't ask. But if the opportunity presents itself, I'll find out."
"Who is this guy?"
asked the president. He pointed to a photograph of a handsome man sitting on the back bench of a power launch. "That, sir, is what we are trying to find out. The Brits were able to pick up some low-quality audio of the prince talking with this unknown individual, and it's very interesting. The prince was easier to understand because he was louder." Kennedy flipped the photo and revealed a typed transcript of the discussion between Omar and his visitor. The president donned his reading glasses and followed along. "Subject 1. Your Highness, I am. Implement your plan. There are things to be done, little room for error. Prince Omar, how close? Subject 1. Close. Prince Omar, when will it start? Subject 1. Within week." Kennedy passed over several paragraphs as they were unimportant and found the next important passage. Subject 1. "There is you could for me. Prince Omar, would that have money?" Subject 1. They driven into action by rage. I give them." Prince Omar, "How much more do you need?" Subject 1. Response unintelligible. Prince Omar, 10 million. You have become far too greedy." Subject 1. Response unintelligible. Prince Omar, 5 million. Subject 1. Prince Omar, what one thing you most pleasure in?
Prince Omar, to see Israel destroyed. Subject 1. Exactly. 10 million. Pittance. And for it, self-destruction. Zionist state.
President Hayes slowly took off his glasses and looked at Kennedy cautiously. Do we have the actual audio of this conversation?
Yes, our people are working on it right now, but I doubt they'll be able to do much more with it than the Brits already have.
The president grabbed one of the photos and asked again, Who is this man?
We don't know yet.
Turbis leaned forward. Sir, I've got the best people of the CTC looking into this. I'm hopeful we'll get an ID on him within a day or two.
There's one more thing, Mr. President. Kennedy closed the file. The Brits say the prince and this man met again in Cannes last Saturday. Apparently they had some problems with their audio surveillance, so the tape of their conversation has yielded very little, but they were able to confirm one thing.
And what is that?
The Brits say the man was headed for America.
Why? Asked Hayes in confusion. I thought he stated in the transcript that the target was Israel.
Kennedy shook her head. I don't know, sir. We're trying to sort this all out.
Irene, the president said with a bit of a disappointed tone, I know I've told you countless times to keep me in the loop, but I think all you've done here this morning's confused me.
I would have much rather taken a day or even a week to flesh this out, but considering what happened in New York last night, I wanted to make you aware of it as soon as possible.
But why? Hayes shook his head. This transcript tells me the target of these two is Israel, not the United States. Then why did John Doe leave France for the United States?
Rapp paced slowly behind the couch, not bothering to look at the president or his boss.
If his goal is Israel, then he should be headed in the other direction. Or maybe MI6 is reading too far into this, or we're taking the wrong meaning from it.
Rapp looked down at the president.
Arabs are famous for being shameless braggarts when it comes to Israel. They puff up their chests and throw around wild, brutal ideas, but rarely do they ever follow through on them. What if all we heard on that tape was a business transaction that...
Rapp thought of something Kennedy had said in the meeting.
What if Prince Omar was involved in an arms deal with Ali and he got burned?
Hayes looked at Rapp with a skeptical frown and asked, Do you really think that's what this is about, Mitch?
I'm not sure, sir. It's too early to tell. I'm just trying to throw out some other possibilities before we get swept up in this blame Israel storm.
The president didn't feel like hearing any dissension this morning. Ben Friedman had abused the trust of his country's greatest supporter, and until someone gave him hard evidence to the contrary, Friedman would continue to be the focus of the president's ire.
Mitch, do you trust Ben Friedman?
Rapp didn't waver for a second.
Of course not.
Hayes nodded.
And you think he's capable of something this reckless?
This time Rapp took a moment to consider the full breadth of the question.
Absolutely. If it means protecting his country, I think he's capable of almost anything.
The president concurred with a firm nod.
But, Rapp added quickly, one thing doesn't quite make sense. I think the fact that the assassination took place in New York City leaves some doubt.
Why, because you don't think he'd risk offending us?
Yeah.
Hayes scowled.
I don't think Ben Friedman worries about offending anyone.
But Prime Minister Goldberg does, answered Valerie Jones. His coalition cabinet is ready to fall right over the edge of the cliff. If he gets implicated in this, the Knesset will vote him out like that.
Jones snapped her fingers in the air.
Sir, warned Kennedy, all we're trying to say is let's be very careful about what positions we take until we know more.
After sitting back, Hayes thought about Kennedy's cautionary words and sighed. Her advice went against his instincts. He'd lost all patience with Ben Friedman and his lying ways, but he knew Kennedy was right. He looked at her and nodded.
All right. For now we stay quiet about all this, but, looking to Rapp and Turbis, he said, find out who this man is and if he had anything to do with Ambassador Ali's assassination.
Rapp nodded, but Turbis was preoccupied with reading an email off his BlackBerry. The director of the CTC glanced up from the small screen, a grim expression on his face, and announced,
Three suicide bombs just went off in Israel.
President Hayes placed a hand over his face and said,
Oh, God, this just keeps getting worse.
Chapter 55
The old house wasn't in the nicest neighborhood, and it wasn't in the best condition, but it served its purpose. It was right on the bubble where North D.C. bordered Northeast D.C. Compared to the southeast quadrant of the city, the neighborhood was tame, but trouble could still be found if you didn't pay attention to where you were going at 2 in the morning. That was the Washington take on things, but having spent most of his life living under occupation, David found the neighborhood to be extremely safe. He'd pass himself off to the landlord as a French software designer who owned his own company and was trying to break into the U.S. market. He would only be in D.C. sporadically, as meetings with his lobbying firm and the Department of Commerce dictated, but when he was in town, he would need ample space to continue his work. The rent was reasonable, and the landlord didn't balk when David handed over the first 2 months plus deposit in cash. In the 5 months since then, David had wired the rent to the landlord from a dummy account in Paris that matched his false identity of Jean Racine. David's only request, which he offered to pay for, was to upgrade the electrical service in one of the upstairs rooms and get the house wired for high-speed internet access. The landlord, who lived a little more than a mile away, objected to neither and stayed true to his promise that he wouldn't bother David as long as David was a quiet and respectful tenant. Now David sat in the converted office on the second floor of the Victorian home and concentrated on the array of visual equipment before him. Mounted on the wall were 8 Sony 21-inch flat-screen monitors costing over $1,000 each. 2 workstations were set up on the long folding table that served as a desk. The station on the left was for checking email, managing his funds, which were spread out at various financial institutions around the world, and keeping an eye on a certain online news service that provided almost instantaneous access to what was going on at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The other workstation was dedicated to controlling the other 7 monitors as they fed him live feeds from traffic cameras around the city. That part of the plan had been achieved with less effort than he had anticipated. Simple bribery had bought him access to the Washington, D.C. Department of Motor Vehicles traffic camera network. At any given moment, he was just a few keystrokes away from accessing any one of the more than 100 cameras located throughout the district. The password to enter the system had cost him only $2,000. The DMV was a true menagerie of immigrants, most of whom had come from third-world countries where government salaries were often augmented by bribes and payoffs. The young Palestinian who he approached leaped at the chance to make a little extra money and never once asked why the stranger from his homeland wanted access to such information. The man could have thrown out a decent guess, but he would have assumed wrong. David had his eyes set on a very ripe target, one that would enrage the United States and unite the Arab world. The pressure for peace in the Middle East and a free and autonomous Palestinian state was about to reach an apogee. David just needed one simple meeting to take place, and he would spring the trap. Chapter 56 Rapp followed Turbis down the sterile hallway of the new headquarters building of the George Bush Center for Intelligence. The CTC had been recently relocated from its relatively small space on the 6th floor of the original headquarters building to the bottom 2 floors of the south wing of the new structure. This massive increase in space, staff, and budget was a reflection of just how seriously Washington was now taking the threat of terrorism. To Rapp's mind, this was a mixed blessing. The new funding was great for buying high-tech equipment and training new people, but it also brought with it more oversight, more accounting, more red tape, and in general, more people getting in each other's way. Rapp was an advocate of small, specialized teams that could react quickly and plan operations with as little interference as possible. Instinctively, he recoiled against large organizations, and for that reason, more than probably any other, he always felt a little uncomfortable entering the new CTC. Turbis stopped at a door and slid his ID through the magnetic card reader while Rapp loosened the knot of his tie and undid the top button of his dress shirt. They had barely entered the CTC, and analysts were already lining up to have a word with Turbis.
Somewhere near the back of the line, Rapp spotted Marcus Dumond and Olivia Bourne. Dumond was the CTC's resident computer genius, and Bourne was the senior regional analyst for the Gulf States. Officially, she had nothing to do with Saudi Arabia. Unofficially, she kept as close a watch on the Saudi royal family as politics would allow. When Rapp had been brought in from the field and named special assistant to the DCI on counterterrorism, Kennedy had sat him down and given him an overview on the CTC. At the top of the list of the center's most valuable people, Kennedy had placed Olivia Bourne. The 39-year-old West Virginian had an undergraduate degree from Brown and a graduate degree from Princeton. She had literally no field experience but was a walking encyclopedia when it came to tracking the Islamic Radical Fundamentalists, or IRFs, who they hunted. Kennedy hadn't bothered to brief Rapp on Marcus Dumond, since it was Rapp who had recruited him. Rapp had met Dumond while he was a graduate student at MIT with Rapp's brother. At the time of his recruitment, Dumond had been a 27-year-old computer genius and almost convicted felon. The young cyber genius had run into some trouble with the feds while he was earning his master's degree in computer science at MIT. He was alleged to have hacked into one of New York's largest banks and then transferred funds into several overseas accounts. The part that interested the CIA was that Dumond wasn't caught because he left a trail. He was caught because he got drunk one night and bragged about the looting to the wrong person. When the feds came and broke down his apartment door, Dumond was living with Stephen Rapp. Rapp heard about the incident from his brother and alerted Kennedy, who was then the director of the CTC, that the hacker was worth a look. Langley doesn't like to admit the fact that they employ some of the world's best computer pirates, but these young cyber geeks are encouraged to hack into any and every computer system they can. Most of these hacking raids are directed at foreign companies, banks, governments, and military computer systems, but just getting into a system isn't enough. The challenge is to hack in, get the information, and get out without leaving a trace that the system was ever compromised. Dumond was a natural at it, and his talents were put to good use in the CTC. Both Bourne and Dumond were gesturing to get Rapp's attention. Bourne held up a piece of paper and pointed eagerly to the face on the printout. Rapp bypassed the line and went straight for Bourne, grabbing her by the elbow. He pulled her away from the crowd. Keeping his voice hushed, he asked, "What's up?" Bourne smiled. "We've got a beat on Prince Charming." Rapp's first reaction was to turn and see what Turbis was doing. It looked like two CTC employees were wildly explaining a problem to the head boss in hopes that he would referee their dispute. Rapp looked to Dumond and Bourne and said, "Follow me." The three of them walked down the side aisle of the large open room that held a sea of cubicles. The maze of plastic and fabric dividers was affectionately known as the bullpen to those who worked counterterrorism. When they reached Rapp's office, he unlocked the door with a key and then entered. Glancing at Dumond, he said, "Close the door." Once it was shut, Rapp turned to Bourne, who spoke both Arabic and Farsi fluently, and asked, "What did you find?" Bourne handed over the printout. "Our boy flew from Nice to Paris to JFK on Sunday." Rapp looked at the grainy black-and-white image. "Where'd we get this?"
"Customs surveillance camera at JFK. We scanned the Brit's photos into the facial imaging recognition system and let the computers go to work. We started with our in-house database on known or suspected terrorists and came up blank. So before checking with our allies, I decided to run a search with customs on the hunch that if this guy had anything to do with the Palestinian ambassador, he would have had to enter the country on Sunday or Monday at the latest."
Rapp nodded and looked at the grainy photo. "Are we sure this is him?"
98.63% sure, replied the hyperanalytical Dumond.
Holding the photo up, Rapp asked, "Does he have a name?"
"Charles Utrillo," Bourne replied.
Rapp turned his attention to Dumond, knowing his little hacker would have already done a full background check.
"I suppose that's not his real name?"
"Nope," Dumond shook his head. "I checked several French government databases and came up with nothing."
Dumond handed over a printout.
"Here's the information on the credit card he used to pay for the plane ticket. We're running a search on rental cars and hotels within a 100-mile radius of New York City. If he used the card again, we'll know sometime in the next 30 minutes.
Are you tracing the card on the other end? Asked Rapp.
Yeah, it was set up for automatic payments from a bank in Paris. The account has a little less than $8,000 in it.
Unfortunately, Rapp thought he knew the answer to his next question, but he asked it anyway. And how did that money get into the account?
4 separate cash deposits.
Rapp cringed. This guy was covering his tracks like a real pro. Speaking from experience, Rapp said, "The name's a dead end. Wherever he is now, he's using a different identity."
"Even so," asked Bourne, "do you want us to flag his passport and alert the FBI?"
"Flag his passport," answered Rapp, even though he doubted it would do any good. "But hold off on the FBI for a bit. Let me talk to Irene first and see what she wants to do."
Rapp paused and put himself in the shoes of the assassin for a moment. He tried to guess what the man's next move would be. His options were to either stay in New York and wait until things settled down or leave immediately. If it was Rapp, he would have left immediately. Canada would have been his first choice and then head back to Europe, or if he had time, head west. "Start checking security cameras at the 3 major airports from 8 last night until this morning. Concentrate on outgoing international flights, especially anything bound for Canada."
"We're in the process of doing it right now," answered Bourne. "Do you want me to check with the DGSE or Mossad and see if we can get a match on the photo?"
Normally, Rapp wouldn't think twice about checking with either the French or Mossad, but given the current situation, he hesitated. "Not yet. I need to run this by Irene first." He checked his watch and then asked, "Anything else?"
"Yeah," said Bourne. "Ask her if we can bring the feds and local law enforcement in on this."
Rapp nodded. Remembering something, he asked Dumont, "How are you coming with the prince's finances? $10 million is a lot of money. There has to be a sign of it moving from one account to another."
Dumont shook his head in frustration.
$10 million is nothing to a guy like this. It'll take me the rest of the day just to try and identify all of the various accounts he uses, and even then I could miss a few that I'm sure he keeps hidden."
"I don't care what it takes. Get it done. Pull all the people you need for the busy work, and I'll get Irene to authorize it. I want to know who this guy is, and unless Olivia gets lucky, the best way to catch him is to follow the money trail."
Chapter 57
The sun was down and rush hour was over as Rapp turned onto the chain bridge and hit the gas. His turbo Volvo S80 shot across the low-slung bridge like a rocket. When he reached the other side, he hung a right and again floored it. He was already 15 minutes late for his 8 o'clock dinner date with his wife. At Reservoir Road, he hung a left and shot across a lane of traffic and into a residential neighborhood just north and west of Georgetown University. Anna had picked the restaurant. It was in Glover Park on Wisconsin Avenue. Austin Grill was a little hole in the wall that served great margaritas and decent Mexican food. Unfortunately, Rapp wouldn't be drinking any margaritas tonight. As soon as dinner was over, he'd have to head right back to Langley. They were no closer to finding out who Prince Omar's minion was than they were 8 hours ago. Kennedy had given them the green light to bring in the counterterrorism people at the FBI, but had decided against alerting France or Israel. Bourne had done a routine search through Interpol's database, shuffling John Doe's photograph in with a half dozen others they were interested in. The intent was to make Interpol think it was a standard query and nothing to get excited about. Against everyone's hopes, the search came up empty. The pressure from the White House wasn't helping. If they didn't know more by tomorrow morning, Rapp was prepared to get on a plane and fly to France. He had a few ideas about how he could crack this thing open, and his best hope lay with Prince Omar's personal assistant, the effeminate Devon Leclerc. The Brits had provided a brief bio of the man, and it appeared he was the most likely person to handle Omar's nefarious activities. Rapp was willing to bet he could get the guy to crack inside of 5 minutes. In the meantime, he'd given Dumont orders to take a close look at the Frenchman. Rapp took a left onto 37th Street, braking for several students who were lollygagging in the crosswalk, and then accelerated up the hill. Less than a minute later, he turned, heading south onto Wisconsin Avenue, and grabbed the first available spot. Climbing out of the car, he winced slightly as he put weight on his bad leg, and then did a quick 360-degree check of the area.
Rapp entered the bar with the collar of his jacket turned up and his head down, trying to look as inconspicuous as possible. He squeezed past the young crowd that was bellied up to the bar. Even on a Tuesday night, the place did great business. With every step, he scanned faces and checked things out. He headed for the balcony, where they always sat, and hobbled up the stairs. Just like a good girl, he found his wife sitting in the corner with her back to the wall. Rapp smiled without hesitation, his deeply tanned face showing a pair of creased dimples. He hurried over to her and said, "Sorry I'm late, honey." Anna smiled and offered her lips. She was usually the one who was late, so she couldn't complain. Rapp kissed her and took off his jacket, careful not to let his suit coat open too far and alarm any of the other patrons by revealing the gun in his shoulder holster. He took a seat next to his wife, so they both had their backs to the wall. Taking her hand, he asked, "How was your day?" Anna took a drink of water and said, "Pretty hectic. People are really freaking out about the Palestinian ambassador."
"Tell me about it," responded Rapp.
"I heard the president went ballistic when he found out."
Rapp thought about it for a second. He wasn't happy, but I don't think I'd describe it as going ballistic.
Anna wasn't sure if her husband was spinning her or telling the truth. "You guys have any idea who did it?"
"We've got a few leads."
"Nothing you can talk about," finished Anna. Rapp smiled and kissed her again.
"You're figuring this game out."
She laughed and said, "Oh, I'm not done with you yet." Staring at him with her emerald eyes, she said, "The word on the street is that the president thinks the Israelis are responsible." Inside, Rapp felt his gut tighten. The president had no business letting a rumor like this get started. At this point, any suspicion aimed at Israel was based on the president's hatred and distrust of Ben Friedman and nothing more. What little evidence they had pointed in a very different direction and one that he could not share with his wife.
"We have very little to go on right now, but I don't think the Israelis did it."
A waitress showed up at the table and dropped off a red, white, and blue swirly margarita. She asked Rapp what he wanted, and as tempted as he was to follow suit, he settled for a bottle of Lone Star beer instead. When the waitress was gone, Anna asked, "Why don't you think Israel did it?"
Rapp frowned. "Let's change the subject. How's your mother?"
Anna took a sip of her drink and said, "You never ask about my mother."
"That's not true. How's she doing?"
"She's fine. Now tell me why you don't think the Israelis did it." Rapp was about to put up the stone wall and then remembered where it had gotten him lately. She was his wife, and as long as he didn't get into details, there was probably no harm in explaining his opinion. "I know a lot of Israelis, and although they're a little crazy at times, they are far from stupid. Unless there's something about Ambassador Ali that we don't know, I see no benefit to Mossad taking him out."
"Unless," said Anna, "they feel so isolated their only choice was to lash out."
Rapp was already shaking his head. "Not here in the United States."
"What if they're thumbing their nose at the UN?"
Anna took another sip. "Why not kill him when he's in the West Bank and avoid offending their one true ally?"
"Maybe they couldn't get at him when he's in the West Bank."
Rapp laughed. His wife obviously knew very little of Mossad's capabilities. "Trust me, Mossad could have taken him down any one of a dozen times in the last year."
"Well," Anna said a bit defensively, "I'm hearing the president is pretty convinced it was the Israelis."
Rapp was tempted to tell his wife that the president didn't know what in the hell he was talking about, but discretion won out, and he simply said, "We'll know a lot more in a few days. And until then, I think we should all keep our theories to ourselves." Anna smelled dissension and pounced.
"So the CIA and the president are in disagreement."
Smiling and shaking his head, he said, "You're awful. I never said any such thing. You asked your husband his personal opinion, and that's what I gave you. In no way does it reflect the official opinion of either the president or the CIA.
Anna made a funny face while sucking on her straw.
When she came up for air, she said, "Nice try. I'm going to lead the news with it in the morning." She held her drink in front of her mouth like a microphone. Using her fake on-air voice, she said, "Breaking news here at the White House. Major dissension between President Hayes and the CIA."
Rapp almost took the bait and then caught himself. "By the way,
Aren't you wondering how my ass is doing?
Anna shook her head. Nope. Your current ailment is nobody's fault but your own. You'll get no sympathy from me.
Rapp pulled a woebegone face.
My doctor tells me I might never be able to have sex again.
Anna tried her best not to smile. The divorce papers will be on your desk in the morning.
Rapp burst out laughing. It was the first time in several days, and it felt great. As he looked into his wife's eyes, he wished he didn't have to go back to the office, but he did. He had to find out who this guy was, and when he did, he would demand that the president allow him to launch an operation that set an example, an operation that would send a warning to people who wanted to finance terrorism. He knew the president would be reluctant to grant him the authority to do what he wanted, so he would have to work that much harder to make sure he had overwhelming evidence and sound reason on his side.
Chapter 58.
It wasn't quite 7 on Wednesday morning when David entered the tiny garage behind the house he was renting. Inside was a stripped-down white Ford minivan with no seats or windows in the rear passenger area. David had done all of his dry runs without the van, even though he was confident the bomb wouldn't go off unless it was armed. He erred on the side of caution and kept it locked up in the garage. As he slid the key into the ignition, he couldn't help but catch himself worrying that starting the engine might bring about a premature end to his plans. The concern was foolish. He'd read all the manuals ad nauseam. There were ample materials available on explosives, if one was willing to look, and besides, his people had become experts on bombs over the last 2 decades. The more difficult aspect of the plan had been obtaining the amount of explosives he needed and then getting them into the United States. The now deceased General Hamza had been kind enough to supply him with 3 separate shipments of Iraqi-made Semtex, a very powerful plastic explosive, and then, using a series of export companies, he had shipped a large cargo container from Jordan to Indonesia and then finally to the busy port of Los Angeles. From there, the container had made its way east to Richmond, Virginia, where it sat in a storage facility for 2 months while David made sure it wasn't being watched. 12 40-pound blocks of the clay-like Semtex sat in the back of the van under a canvas painter's tarp. Underneath the tarp was a maze of det cord and blasting caps that would ensure the near-simultaneous detonation of the 480 pounds of explosives. David backed up slowly until he reached the street and then headed south. Due to all the government jobs, D.C. was not a city of early risers, and the traffic was still light. He cut down a cross street and then turned the van onto Georgia Avenue. A short while later, he passed Howard University, and then Georgia turned into 7th Street. He was now less than a mile from the White House. After stopping for a red light, he took a right onto Rhode Island and continued in the right lane, avoiding as many potholes as he could. He was more nervous now than when he had killed Ali. There was something about D.C. All the cameras and various law enforcement agencies each presented the possibility of capture. To David, it was truly unbelievable that a city with so many cops in it could have such a high murder rate. But that was America. He tried not to be overly optimistic about his odds of succeeding. He'd covered his tracks diligently and monitored the FBI's website hourly, waiting for a photograph of him to appear at any moment. But it hadn't. They had no idea who he was, and if the papers were to be believed, the entire world, even the Americans, believed that the Israelis were responsible for the assassination of Ambassador Ali. Everything was going according to plan. Now all he needed to do was make one last grand statement, an act of pure violence that would force Israel to concede. He turned onto the desired street, less than a quarter mile from the White House, and slowed for a car that had abruptly pulled out in front of him. David continued north for 2 more blocks, in search of the optimal parking place. Much of the credit for this last bold move had to be given to Omar. He had convinced David that the best way to force Israel to the table was to enrage the Americans, spill blood on their soil, and watch them lose their patience with Israel. Now, more than ever, David was convinced it would work. The French ambassador to the UN was scheduled to bring a resolution for Palestinian statehood before the Security Council at 11 this morning. So far, everyone was on board, minus the United States, but unfortunately that wasn't enough. As a permanent member of the Council, the American ambassador had veto power. As things stood right now, the Americans were not ready to back the French resolution, but that was about to change. After David was done this morning, the vote would probably have to be postponed, but its odds of passing would be greatly increased. David carefully parallel parked the van, and then plugged the meter with enough quarters to last into the afternoon. Standing next to the parking meter, he took one last look at the van and made sure he'd done everything. The tabs were up to date, the meter was full, and the bomb could not be seen from the front window. As casually as his nerves would allow, he turned and began walking away from the vehicle. He would wait to arm the bomb when he got back to the house, after he was sure his target was on the way.
Chapter 59.
Rapp stepped out of the shower in the men's locker room of the new headquarters building and grabbed a towel. He'd managed to sneak in a few hours' sleep on the couch in his office, and right about now he was wondering if that had been such a good idea. Due to his wound, he'd had to sleep on his side, with his head up on the armrest. The contorted angle of his neck had given him a kink that a steaming hot 15-minute shower had done nothing to fix. As he dried off, he told himself to ignore it. There were bigger problems to deal with, like finding this prick who worked for Fat Omar. That's what Rapp had taken to calling the Saudi prince, refusing to grant him his regal title. With the aid of a full-length mirror, he taped a new bandage over his wound and got some clean clothes out of his locker. It was common for those who worked in the CTC to keep a change of clothes at work. When a crisis erupted, there usually wasn't enough time to sleep, let alone go home and get changed. Rapp was standing in his boxers when the locker room door flew open, and a disheveled Marcus Dumont burst in, yelling Rapp's name.
"Mitch! Mitch!
Over here!" yelled Rapp. Dumont skidded to a stop at the end of the aisle. "You gotta get upstairs. Olivia found something." Rapp pulled his pants on.
"What?"
"She's got a lead on this guy, and you're not gonna like it." Rapp stood over Bourne's shoulder, his thick black hair wet and uncombed, staring at the flat-screen monitor. For the third time in a row, he watched the man walk across the expansive floor of Penn Station, and for the third time in a row he asked Bourne, "Are you sure it's him?" She smiled confidently and said,
"Yep, the software mapped his face and gave us a lock on the surveillance photos the Brits provided."
Rapp watched the man in the dark trench coat. The times worked out. Kill Ali, get away from the area, dispose of the weapon, and then catch a train out of town. Or go to the station and make everybody think you got on a train, then duck back outside and disappear. Rapp had used the trick himself on more than one occasion. "Have you checked to make sure he didn't turn around and come back out?"
"No need to," replied a confident Bourne. She made a couple of keystrokes, and more black-and-white surveillance footage came up on the second monitor. Bourne handed Rapp a printout that showed the schedule of trains leaving Penn Station for the night in question. Rapp looked down at the one she had circled and squinted to read the small type.
"Going off of that," offered Bourne, "I pulled the footage at Union Station. The train left New York at 10:05 and pulled into D.C. at 1:20 in the morning."
Bourne hit her enter key like a concert pianist, striking the final note of a glorious performance, and then, sitting back, she crossed her arms and watched the digital video stream play across her screen.
"That's our guy walking across the lobby right there."
Rapp didn't bother to ask if she was sure this time. "The bastard's in D.C.," he mumbled more to himself than Bourne. His mind instantly seized, not on who he should call or where the man might be, but rather on who he was after. When you stripped away all the bullshit, Rapp was an assassin. He was also much more than that, of course, but in the most raw, blunt way, he was an assassin. He understood the thought processes involved in running an operation virtually alone. It was his preferred mode. That way, he didn't have to worry about anyone other than himself screwing up. This guy looked like he was operating alone, and if Rapp was guessing right, there was only one reason why he would come to D.C. He wasn't done killing. "Do we have any more footage on him?"
No, this is it.
Damn it, swore Rep. Have you told Jake?
No, he's on his way up to the Hill to brief the Intel Committee.
Irene?
No, she's on her way to the White House.
Rapp stood up straight and looked across the sea of cubicles at the far wall to see if Tom Lee, the CTC's deputy director, was in his office. If Rapp had been a typical government employee, he would already be racing across the bullpen on his way to tell Lee everything he had just learned. Needless to say, Rapp was more than some bureaucrat worried about covering his ass and making sure his government pension was protected at all costs. This was a tricky situation. Lee was not an employee of the CIA. He merely had an office in the building. He was FBI, and with the FBI came a lot of rules on how things were handled, rules that Rapp felt got in the way. Rapp had to make a quick decision. They needed to catch this guy, but they didn't want to spook him. Plus, once they told the FBI about him, there was no taking it back, no flexibility in how to handle the situation. He decided on a cautious course for the moment. Looking down at Bourne and Dumond, who were seated, he said, "Call the cab companies and find out who was working the station at the time this guy stepped onto the curb, and," Rapp lowered his voice, "keep it within our little group right here." Both Bourne and Dumond nodded. They were CIA and knew exactly what Rapp was talking about. "And Marcus, keep working on Fat Omar's accounts. There should have been a large chunk of change moved sometime in the last week. If anything comes up, call me on the digital." Rapp grabbed the printout of the surveillance photo and a train schedule and started for the exit. "Where are you going?" asked Dumond. Rapp folded the printouts and shoved them into his pocket. "The White House."
This ends Disc 9.